Very nice to go back to Canada. I actually came here on a Sunday in the middle of all the jubilation, so it's lots of fun. Okay, so let me talk about some recent work that we've been doing with Carlos Fuertes, who's actually a string theorist, and my advisor, Subir Sajdev at Harvard, on entanglement entropy. And this is quite a technical story, but I don't feel like I should apologize for technicality here. I mean, okay. So, but let me start by trying to give you the motivation for studying this problem. So most of our present understanding of phase transitions comes from the honorable Landau-Ginzburg paradigm, which was essentially developed to describe classical phase transitions. And for such classical phase transitions, we basically distinguish phases of matter by their order. And so when we go from one phase to another, typically some symmetry is spontaneously broken. And once we know the pattern of spontaneous symmetry breaking, we can construct the relevant order parameter and write down an effective theory for it. And then we actually immediately know the universality class of the phase transition. So for classical phase transitions, this story is very well understood. But for quantum phase transitions, it's believed that so quantum phase transitions are, of course, transitions which occur at zero temperature. And for those transitions, it's believed that the physics is much more rich. And there are transitions that fall outside of this Landau-Ginzburg paradigm, where it's not enough to specify, to describe things based on a local order parameter. So, and perhaps you shouldn't really be too attached to your classical intuition, because these quantum phase transitions really realize some of the most non-classical states of matter. Excitations at these phase transitions are very, very unusual. And more than that, the ground states here are very highly entangled. So what we'd like to develop is a kind of approach which is complementary to Landau theory, which is not too attached to local order parameters and correlation functions. And one idea that people are trying to pursue is to create an approach which is based on entanglement of the wave function. Okay, so how do we quantify entanglement? Well, first of all, we have to say entanglement between what and what. So, we start with our system, and we somehow divide it into two regions that we pick, A and B. And we'd like to describe entanglement between these regions. And so to understand that, we can start with the density matrix of our system, and let's just start with a pure state. And then let's trace over the degrees of freedom in the subsystem B. And then generally, the reduced density matrix that you get this way will be in a mixed state. That is, if you can only perform measurements on subsystem A, you know perfectly well that the system will appear as if it's in a mixed state. Okay, so now you can take this reduced density matrix and you can diagonalize it. And generally, you get some spectrum of eigenvalues. And that spectrum of eigenvalues is known as entanglement spectrum. And it contains a lot of information about kind of entanglement between the two subregions. Now, we're not going to study all of that information in this talk. We are going to concentrate just on one quantity, which is so-called entanglement entropy, which is just the von Neumann entropy associated with this reduced density matrix. So this entanglement entropy is, I would say, some kind of inherently quantum mechanical, non-local observable, which is very different from the typical, from usual correlation functions that we study. So let's see if we can find some interesting behavior of these observables near phase transitions, and let's see if we can classify phase transitions based on this observable. Yes? Pardon me? Yeah, so that's a good question. So, so it's observable in some kind of thought experiment. So there is actually no experimental way to probe this, and the reason is precisely because it's, you know, it's non-local, right? So at the moment we don't know an experimental way to measure this. There are some systems where this observable turns out to coincide with some other physically measurable observable, such as shot noise, for example. But those are believed to be coincidental, essentially. Well, first of all, this is at zero temperature, and secondly, you know, you have to somehow break your system into two parts and then measure the resulting entropy, and I don't think that can be done in a meaningful manner. But you have to. I think you basically more or less have to reconstruct the density matrix of your subsystem, of your system, in order to compute this. You can't. There is no simple local probe that you can do. We can discuss more, but I think that's the consensus in the community. Okay, so before we study the exciting problem of how the entanglement entropy behaves at a phase transition, let's first try to understand, if I am in some phase, what happens to this quantity. So let's imagine that I'm in some state of matter that has a finite gap or a finite correlation length. And then I generally expect that, since correlations are finite range, then entanglement should also be finite range. So then I expect all of my entanglement between regions A and B to be basically local to the boundary. And that gives rise to entanglement entropy scaling as the area of the boundary. So this is a so-called area law. Okay, if I'm in two dimensions, it's perimeter law. So this is kind of intuitive on one hand. It's also counterintuitive on another hand. Because if you just take a generic state in the Hilbert space, then the entanglement entropy will scale as the volume of the subsystem, just like the ordinary entropy scales as the volume of the system. So this tells you something very interesting. It tells you that ground states of local Hamiltonians are actually very special. They form a set of measure zero in the full Hilbert space. All right. So this area law actually explains very nicely the reason for success of certain numerical algorithms in one dimension.
A little bit more. Why is the ground state relevant?
Pardon me?
Why is the ground state relevant? You're saying you're looking at the ground state of. Why did the ground state come in?
So
to the argument.
When we are studying these condensed matter systems, most of the time we are interested in the ground state or some low energy state.
Okay. So you're studying the ground state of the combined system, A plus B,
exactly.
And then tracing out.
Exactly. So the entanglement entropy is defined for this ground state. One can also define it for a state of finite temperature, some mixed state, but that's not as good a measurement in state, a measure in a certain sense.
Okay, that's another question.
Since this is very generic, is it interesting to look at corrections? Like terms that go like log area.
So that's what my talk is going to be about.
Oh.
So I think it's
sorry.
Interesting.
No, it's not interesting.
So this area law explains the success of certain numerical algorithms like DMRG in one dimensions, and their total failure in higher dimensions. So essentially, in these algorithms. Performs a kind of renormalization group, and one needs to keep a finite number of states at each step in order, and one essentially keeps states which saturate this density matrix. Well, then the question is how many states do you need to keep? So in one dimension, the area of the boundary, is just one point. So essentially, the number of states that you need to keep doesn't scale with the system size.
Yes. Can you specify what you mean by saturate the density matrix?
Well, you find the ground state of your system, and then you divide it into two halves, essentially. And then you're going to diagonalize this density matrix, but you're only going to keep, say, n largest eigenvalues. And you're going to throw away the rest because, you know, you cannot, you know, because otherwise you'll be solving the problem exactly. So that's exactly what I mean. Right, so now, in one dimension, the number of boundary points is 1, so the number of states that you have to keep doesn't scale with the subsystem size, or with the system size. Whereas in higher dimensions, the area of the boundary scales with the system size, so essentially, you have exponential scaling of the number of states you need to keep with system size, and you're dead. Okay, so this was a little aside, but now coming back, having understood the behavior in a phase, let's go to quantum critical points. And last, let's ask, you know, is there something interesting happening there? And turns out that this question has been answered completely in for quantum critical points in one spatial dimension. Well, for a certain class of quantum critical points in one spatial dimension, those which have dynamical exponents z equal to 1 and are described by conformal field theory. And this conformal field theory is understood really well. I mean, there are some experts in the audience. Okay, so it turns out that for such systems, if you look at the entanglement entropy of an interval of length L, it scales at the logarithm of the interval size with a coefficient which is related to the central charge of the conformal field theory. So this result is very striking. First of all, it tells you that your entanglement at the one-dimensional quantum critical point is really a long range. You know, you have entanglement essentially on all length scales. It also tells you that by looking at the free factor here, you can extract some universal information with this central charge, which is one of the, you know, most important properties of the CFT. So there is universality. So what's also interesting, if you perturb your critical point slightly by relevant perturbation, yes?
I'm just looking at this cutoff. So this is something like the black hole case, apparently, in the sense that without a cutoff, the entropy is infinite, the entanglement entropy is infinite.
Well, in condensed matter systems, in this lattice, there's always a lattice.
Sure. But so if you said you computed this in the conformal field theory.
Well, I mean, there are good divergences in conformal field theories, so you always need to renormalize, right?
I'm not complaining about it. I'm just asking to make sure I understand.
Strictly speaking, if you did say, you know, if you take the ratio of L over A to infinity, then this is divergent. Okay, so now if you perturb your system away by correlation, by finite correlation length, then as one might expect, you know, you should no longer, once your system size is larger than the correlation length, you should recover area law, so you should no longer system scale with the subsystem size. So this divergence is cut off by the finite correlation length. Okay, so this is the situation in 1D, and it's very encouraging. So let's go to higher dimensions. And here we have a rather unpleasant surprise. Well, maybe not a surprise. Turns out that even at a quantum critical point, the entanglement entropy generically scales as the area of the boundary as well, as in a nearby phase. And the coefficient in this area law is non-universal. And it's very easy to understand this non-universality. So entanglement entropy is a number, is a dimensionless quantity. So now, you know, the area of the boundary is a dimensionful quantity. So if you want to extract a dimensionless quantity, you have to normalize by some length scale. And at a quantum critical point, you know, you are conformal. So you don't have any length scale except for the short distance cutoff. So you have this short distance cutoff in the denominator, so your coefficient in front will be sensitive to some microscopic details. So this area law is expected to hold for systems which are described by local field theories. There are violations of this area law for systems described by non-local field theories. So, for example, you know, if you have a Fermi surface, then it's known that this area law is violated by a logarithmic correction like this. And it's easy to understand where such logarithmic corrections come from. So essentially, here you have an infinite set of zero energy, of low energy excitations living on a Fermi surface, right? So essentially, you have a 1 plus 1 dimensional field theory for each position on the Fermi surface. And then you know, each one of them gives you a logarithmic contribution to the entanglement entropy, and then you just have to count up the number of those field theories, essentially, and you get this area law in front. So this is nice and understood, but I'll not focus on such, I'll only focus in my talk on theories which are described by essentially, where low energy effective description is a local field theory. And there we have this area law. Okay, so, you know, we're kind of disappointed the leading result is non-universal, but let's look at subleading terms. In general, I can write the following ansatz for the entanglement entropy, so I can, by subleading terms, I mean terms which are subleading in the system, in the subsystem size. So I can write down the following ansatz, a kind of polynomial in the subsystem size, and the first, basically, d minus 1 terms here scale as some power of subsystem size. So they must, by the same argument as the leading term was non-universal, they all must be non-universal. And then there are some terminating terms here, which have the potential to be universal. And I'll talk about this in a second. So first of all, let me say, where do these non-universal terms come from? What do you mean exactly?
That's this g, the first one, when you change the cutoff, of course this g will change, right? That's yes. Not universal. The second one as well with a different power. Can you construct appropriate combination to become universal?
No. I mean, this is just some kind of expansion in the in the subsystem size, right?
Mm-hmm.
So how do you?
How do you define the terms individually?
Coefficient L to the d minus one.
No, but
I know.
But these terms, they're kind of individually non-universal. So if you take ratios of individually non-universal terms, you'll not get something universal. I mean, it doesn't work like this. It's not like a, you're thinking in terms of some kind of ratios, amplitude ratios in a field theory. No, it's not like that here. But it turns out that, you know, all these non-universal terms essentially have to come from the boundary, because you expect that any universal physics will have to do with long-range entanglement. No, but they're related essentially to different, their short distance sensitivities are different. They don't cancel out in some way. That's my statement. No. Even if you take, I understand that you want to take the appropriate power, but even if you take the appropriate power, you don't expect the short distance sensitivity to cancel out. It's not like, you know, some kind of endpoint correlation function of field phi versus endpoint correlation function of the field phi, where it's essentially the same z factor that you have to multiply by in order to cancel the divergences out. It's just completely unrelated UV physics. Precisely. So that's the non-universality. Pardon me?
I mean, you're subtracting off a whole bunch of very divergent terms, and then you're finding that what's left over is insensitive to how you take
the definition of log L is independent of the current. Log of L over A is log L plus log A, or minus log A, I should say.
That's
so the coefficient of the log L is different.
Oh, the coefficient is well defined, but
I think that's what he's saying.
But if you change the way in which you implement the cutoff, not the magnitude of the cutoff, but the way in which you implement it, can't that affect the...
It'll affect all the others, but not...
All these guys.
Yeah.
You say it won't affect...
Yeah. So that's why I'm saying that all these leading terms are non-universal. You know, given some lattice model, you know, there will be some value for these coefficients, but it will be different for each individual realization of your same universality class of the phase transition. So that's precisely my statement. But now, okay.
Is it supposed to be clear that the log 1 will be insensitive, or is it supposed to be a miracle that when...
Well, it's not quite... That's something that you expect, but of course, you know, you have to go ahead and check.
Uh-huh.
So let me get back to your question. So let me finish about these non-universal terms. Essentially, they have to come from the boundary. They have to come from some kind of short distance entanglement close to the boundary. So we expect that these objects will be integrals of some geometric quantities over the boundary. And the area law is just essentially integral of 1 over the boundary, you know, very simple. But higher order, some other subleading coefficients can involve, say, the curvature of the boundary, something like that. Okay, so let me now finally come to these last two terms that have already generated some debate. So there is this logarithmic term, and I claim that the coefficient in front of it is, in fact, universal. And I also claim that there is this n constant, which is generally a function of the system subsystem size to the correlation length. And that will be universal up to, essentially, additive corrections from this guy. In particular, if this g naught vanishes, then I claim that's completely universal.
How do you change the correlation length? Are you thinking that as being an adjustable quantity?
Yes, so I'm thinking of, I have a critical point, and I have some relevant perturbation that I can use to drive my system away from the critical point. Now, of course, how I define the correlation length, you know, that's up to me. So it's a choice that I make. But for each definition, this will be, you know, I can define it from some physical quantity, and then that this is going to be... Okay, so I claim that there are some situations in which this scaling form simplifies. And one situation is, suppose I have a boundary which is completely straight and doesn't have any endpoints. Then this boundary doesn't have any interesting geometry. There is no geometric construct on it. So then all of these subleading terms in the expansion have to vanish, and I'll have a... up to this first, beyond this first non-universal area law, I'll just have this universal function at the end. Okay, and so I said that this is true for the straight closed boundary, but it's actually also believed to be true for general smooth closed boundaries in two spatial dimensions. So how can you get, situations where you have this g naught, this other universal piece, being non-zero. And there are two examples which are known. One is if your boundary has corners, then each corner can essentially contribute a log. And another case where you know that you generate these logs is in three spatial dimensions, if your boundary has some curvature. Then the curvature is enough to give you logs. OK. But I will not generally discuss these cases where g naught is non-zero. Okay. So let's, yes? Well, there are not that many. So in two dimensions, there is just L over A, right? And then there is possibly G naught log L. And then there is some S naught. So I'm saying that if your boundary doesn't have any corners, then this thing is absent, and I just have this finite and constant. Okay. So I'm going to look at smooth closed boundaries in dimension between 1 and 3, and there are lots of dimensions there. So in this case, as I said, I have this final terminating function. Well, let me go to the quantum critical point, yes? Okay, so let me, as I said, these non-universal terms, or rather this UV divergences, the sensitivity to short distance cutoff has to come from the boundary. And if your boundary doesn't have any geometry, if it's straight, then there is no construct on it. But if your boundary has corners, then each corner has the potential of doing some, of introducing some non-universality, right?
Splitting of an operator product, and I'm point splitting by little a, and if there's no structure, I can just bring them together, and I'm not going to generate anything. It's only if there's some structure, like on a corner, where I'm going to generate something where log of a becomes relevant.
Yes. So I think that's the right. That's more or less the right picture, except these are not local operators. So you know that, for example, if you look at Wilson loop expectation values, and you have corners in your Wilson loops, then I believe you can also have logs appearing in the exponent. So it's the same. It's very similar. Okay. So now let me go to the quantum critical point. And at the quantum critical point, instead of this function, I have just a constant, gamma. And this constant, I claim, is a universal constant that characterizes some kind of non-local entanglement in my system. And I would say that this constant is in some sense similar to the so-called Friedmann-Fischer correction to the free energy of a classical, near-classical phase transition. So these Friedmann-Fischer corrections essentially, no, there is a very similar piece of the free energy that scales as the system size. And the coefficient of that is non-universal, just as our area law is non-universal. But then there is a finite n term here, you know, this Friedmann-Fischer constant. And that's universal, and that has been extracted in Monte Carlo simulation. So this is very well confirmed. And I would also like to point out that the only corrections to these scaling forms in both cases are corrections to scaling, which go as L to some negative power, where omega is typically the correction to scaling exponents.
Does it depend on the topology?
So generally, at the quantum, so you're thinking about, that's my next slide, actually. So maybe I should go to my next slide. So there is some connection here to what's known as massive topological phases. So these are not quantum phase transitions, but these are phases where essentially all excitations are gapped. Nevertheless, in these phases, you find that there is similar expression for the entanglement entropy, and there is a similar n constant here, gamma. And this n constant is actually only sensitive to the topology. It's not sensitive to the geometry. And it's related to what's known as the quantum dimension of your system.
In what sense is related to the topology?
Well, so you know that there is this combination of entanglement. In the sense that if you change the boundary of your subsystems, it doesn't change.
Uh-huh. And
whereas generally,
if you put another pole in your system, so that's a topological change, still doesn't change, right?
Well, I mean, I'm not sure whether it's as strong a statement If you look on a cylinder rather than a torus, it's not clear to me that it's the same for every topology.
I think it's the same.
But is it a feature of this particular model, or is it?
Well, for instance, in the CAF model, it's the same, doesn't depend on the
surface on which?
I'm just saying that second generically is a topological feature, this gamma is not true.
You are saying that it's even stronger than topology.
Yes.
That it's just even it's independent both of geometry and
topological. It's a product of the type of topological order that you have. So in that sense, it's topological, but not the topology
of the space.
Of the system.
Alex, does it depend on the topology of the division? I mean, so if you have like a contractible loop, it's different from a non-contractible loop.
Right. So what I'm saying is that if you put your fractional quantum of liquid on a torus or on something with the two candles, for instance, the degeneracy depends on the genus. So this is, but not this gamma is constant.
But if you take a region that's, I mean, there's now topo. I mean, there's all sorts of topologically different regions that you can look at.
Oh, okay. Right.
So does it? I mean,
no,
I
agree with you.
Okay.
It does depend on that.
So it depends on the topology of the region.
The topology of the region.
Yeah.
So if you have
the sub-region.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree.
So if you have two regions, is it additive?
Yeah, so if region A is contractible to a point,
then I get gamma.
If it's two of them,
I get two gamma?
No, but if it's something that goes around
the
torus.
Oh, if you've got a hole in it?
Yeah. No,
if it wraps around the torus.
Around the torus, I see.
Right. So, but for these quantum phase transitions, actually, gamma depends not only on the topology of the subregion, but also on its geometry. So this gamma is much more robust in a sense. In this massive phase, this gamma is much more robust than in at quantum critical point. Okay.
So could you define what this D is?
Well, D is essentially related to this to the description of this effective phase. So it's related, I think Alyosha can tell you better, but it's related to the number of super selection sectors or something like that. Okay. So now, you know, having thought about this universal constant at the phase transition, let's look away from the phase transition, and let's look at this function. And I know that the limit on my subsystem size is much larger than the correlation length, I should recover my area law. However, now the situation is slightly different, which is I can form a dimensionless quantity out of the area of the boundary and the correlation length by normalizing in this way. And then the coefficient in front of this correlation length dependent correction to the entanglement entropy will be universal. So now, you know, I told you a lot. I showed you some kind of scaling ansatz, and I tried to argue that it's sensible. But really, there have been very few computations that have explicitly confirmed this scaling ansatz, and which have explicitly shown that the subleading this constants gamma and r are universal. In fact, so in dimension larger than one, there have been very few calculations. So there have been calculations for free theories, both bosons and fermions. But you know, those are quite non-generic in a certain sense. There have also been calculations at very special phase transitions with z equal to 2, such as the Rorschach-Killson point, or I think the Lifshitz point. And then for those systems, your correlations of your d plus 1 dimensional theory, actually, correlation functions of your d plus 1 dimensional theory reduced to those of a classical two-dimensional CFT. So in a certain sense, it's not truly purely quantum D plus one dimensional. And finally, there have been holographic calculations which have confirmed this ansatz. And I think, you know, all of those have taught us a lot, but it would be nice to confirm this in some interacting generic field theory using field theoretic methods. And that's what we set out to do. And we use the simplest, to my mind, interacting field theory, which is the OM model. So this is, you're probably all familiar with this. This is a theory of a scalar field phi with n components. And it has two phases. There is a phase where the ON rotation symmetry is spontaneously broken and phi has an expectation value. And then there is a phase where this symmetry is restored. And this model can be realized in true condensed matter systems. You can realize n equal 1, n equal 2, n equal 3 in magnetic systems or in cold atom systems. So you can really study this transition. And on the theoretical side, you can extract critical properties of the phase transition very reliably using expansion in epsilon, and so where epsilon is deviation from the upper critical dimension, or a complementary expansion in the inverse number of field components. Okay, so let me tell you what exactly we compute. So first of all, we want to compute this geometric constant gamma. But for that, we have to specify what kind of geometry we use. And we use the simplest geometry imaginable. We take a theory on a cylinder. And we divide the cylinder into two halves along a straight circle. And we compute the entanglement between the two halves. And actually, recently, there has been some work on the transverse field Ising model, which realizes precisely this n equal 1 O(n) transition. So there has been some numerical work that has found evidence for this gamma. So we'd very much like to make contact with that numerical work. Unfortunately, at this point they use a half torus geometry rather than a half cylinder geometry. But in the future, as their simulations get better, they can probably simulate ours as well, our geometry as well.
The earlier calculations you referred to for the free series and other things, did they all confirm this universality?
Yes.
Yeah.
So the other thing we wanted to look at is this correlation length dependent correction and extract this coefficient R, which we also expect to be universal. And as already was pointed out, the value of this coefficient R depends on what you choose for a correlation length. But in the OM model, there is a very natural choice, which is just the inverse mass gap. So that's what we're going to use. OK, and let me jump immediately to results. So here is the result for this universal geometric constant in epsilon expansion. So there is one thing that I didn't tell you, which is that actually we don't quite use a true cylinder. We use twisted boundary conditions along this periodic direction. And that's just due to technical reasons. So the twist phi will appear in all my formulas. Unfortunately, we cannot quite go to phi equal to 0, which would be. So that's just a technical complication. But, you know, so I have some forms here. But what's most interesting is that one can look at the value of gamma at the interacting fixed point. And one can also look at the value of gamma in the non-interacting theory. And one can compare. And turns out that the two have different limits when epsilon goes to 0. And this is very unusual. Because if you're used to computing critical exponents, say, then you're used to the fact that as you approach the upper critical dimension, the anomalous dimensions all go to 0. So the scaling dimensions in an interacting theory and in a non-interacting theory should approach each other. Whereas here, you see that this gamma has different limits. So essentially, the entanglement entropy is somehow very sensitive. It can distinguish the Gaussian fixed point and the interacting fixed point already at leading order. Yes, I'm cheating. So you can, you can make phi into a complex field. Yeah, just double it and then introduce this. Or you can make phi equal to pi and then.
Oh, I see. Then, so then just can, it still works.
Then you can keep it real. We just cannot put phi equal to zero because then there is a zero mode that one has to treat, and it's an extra complication. In principle, perhaps one day we'll be, but you know, since we just want to verify, oh, you the Microsoft PowerPoint has encountered a problem. I really don't want to send an error report. Not at this point, at least. Sorry. So I think it's back and it's working.
Okay.
And what about there? Let's try F1 maybe. Okay, and then I can try another F1. Oh yeah. Do you need to press F1? Oh, thanks. Okay, sorry about that. Right. Okay, so in addition to this gamma, we wanted to look at the value of the correlation length correction. And again, we can evaluate it in the interacting theory, and we get some answer. And what's interesting is that this value is negative, which tells you that the entanglement entropy is largest at the critical point. So this confirms my earlier statement that the quantum critical state has the highest entanglement. And again, here we can compare our answer to the result at the Gaussian fixed point. And it turns out that, again, there are different limits when epsilon goes to zero. Yeah. So when psi, S is largest. So when Xi goes to infinity, this is larger than for Xi finite. S is larger than for Xi finite. The correction is going to zero. That's right. So, but for Xi finite, there is negative correction. So entanglement entropy is smaller. OK. This was this half cylinder geometry. So in addition to the entanglement entropy proper, we can look at the so-called Rini entropy, which has to do with looking at higher moments of your reduced density matrix. And this again is some kind of non-local probe of entanglement. And essentially, the scaling forms that one expects for this Rini entropy are very similar for the scaling forms one expects for the entanglement entropy proper. And in fact, we know the exact expression in one dimension. So here we have, again, this is similar to C over 3 log L, except we have a prefactor that's now dependent on this index n, which I'll call the replica index for reasons that I'll try to explain in a bit. And then in high dimensions, again, we'll have this universal corrections gamma n and rn, which are now, again, dependent on the replica index. OK, so we go ahead and we compute this gamma n and rn. And here, again, we find some surprises. So generally, in the large n limit, based on large n counting, you expect this coefficient rn to scale as n. In the same way, basically you expect this entanglement entropy to be sensitive to the number of degrees of freedom, to scale with the number of degrees of freedom. So in one dimension, it's scaled with the central charge. So here we expect it to scale with n. And then, this is also just technically, that's what you expect. However, instead you find that Rn scales as n squared. So there is kind of violation of large n counting, which is quite cute. So we have computed Rn explicitly in the large n limit in two spatial dimensions. And this has, there is a potential here for comparison with Monte Carlo simulations. Roger, the reference to you has been cut off. But let me say it verbally that there are some very nice recent Monte Carlo simulations by Roger. Where you can actually extract this Rn for an integer, and then we hope that we'll be able to make comparison. Okay, so there are some other interesting features that we find, which is that generally these coefficients gamma n and Rn do not have to be continuous in the replica index. They can be non-analytic, and in fact we find that in the epsilon expansion they always have a discontinuity at a certain value of n. So it's like a phase transition in the replica index. Now, in the physical case d equal to 2, we actually expect that there is no phase transition. But just as a matter of principle, that this non-analyticity is allowed. OK. So in the remaining few, yes? I have a big N, which is the number of flavors of the in the ON model. And I have a little n, which is the replica index, which is just what moment of the reduced density matrix I'm calculating.
Scaling you're talking about is in the big N?
In the big N.
Is your work in any dimension d, or are you?
So it has to be
about epsilon around d equals 2?
So we use two expansions. We use expansion in epsilon, which is expansion essentially in 4 minus epsilon.
What?
4, if you count space and time, then 4 minus epsilon. If you count space, only 3 minus. Okay. And then we use expansion in M, which is valid in any dimension between 2 and 4.
Mm-hmm. So how, to what D's do you trust your epsilon expansion?
Well, so in the OM model, we generally know that epsilon expansion works very well for epsilon equal to 1.
Right.
You know, all these critical exponents, you can extract to high accuracy.
So you think you trust it for 3 or 5?
You trust it for 3, for 5, you essentially mean few.
It's a prefix.
So it's not...
Yeah. So when you say likely absent in D equals 2, what is the evidence for that?
So for large N, there is no non-nullity. For large N,
right.
There is no non-nullity. At D equal 2. There
your
is
epsilon expansion doesn't work.
That's right. So the non-nullity occurs in this range of dimensions.
Which you hope the epsilon expansion is still valid for.
Yes. But now, you know, when N is of order 1, perhaps the epsilon expansion works for larger values of epsilon. So generally, epsilon expansion is much more reliable in the ON model than the large N expansion, just numerically. And we also understand actually the...
Isn't it true that it works well up to 2 loops, and when it goes 3 loops, it becomes worse?
But then people know how to resolve. That is, I think, the okay. So let me briefly tell you how one goes about computing these things. Because generally, you know how to calculate correlation functions in a field theory, but you typically don't go about calculating the entanglement entropy. So how does one calculate something like this? And the way, well, first you have to use this trick that you evaluate Rényi entropy and not the entanglement entropy, and then just take the limit n goes to 1 of the Rényi entropy. Okay, so how do you calculate the Rényi entropy? Well, we know how to calculate matrix elements of this operator, right? It's just path integral between some states, some initial and final state. And then, if you want to look at the reduced density matrix, then essentially you have to trace over the subsystem B. So you have to identify some boundaries here. But now you want to calculate the trace of the nth power of reduced density matrix. So you have to essentially raise this to power n, and you get a path integral in a geometry like this, where the patches with the same, the pieces drawn in the same color are identified. So this is a kind of fun geometry, because you see that when you go around this, so this red point is the boundary. So this is in one dimension, and if you are in higher dimension, there is a boundary coming out of the board. So as you go around this point, go once, jump here, jump here, jump here, jump back. So you have to go 2 pi n times around in order to come back to the same place. So there is a conical singularity at the boundary. So now, let's go to zero temperature. So let's look at the ground state. And then this, what you're doing is you're calculating the partition function of your theory on an n-sheeted Riemann surface. That's kind of cool. Now, I don't think I have to explain to this audience what a conical singularity is. So now, why were things so simple in one dimension? Well, the answer is that you can map an n-sheeted Riemann surface to a one-sheeted Riemann surface analytically using this nth root function. And you know that for 1 plus 1 dimensional theories, analytic functions are conformal transformations. So this just changes the metric by an overall factor, and then, so the two are conformally equivalent. And you can just work with a theory in a usual on a usual plane. Well, in high dimensions, you can still do this mapping, but it will no longer be conformal. It will screw up, the transverse dimensions will not work out. So in high dimensions, you have to really calculate things on an n-sheeted Riemann surface. And that's somewhat of a challenge, technically. OK. So how do we go about our calculation? So let's start. You know, in a free theory, it's essentially simple. Because in the free theory, we have this cylinder and we have some modes. We can go to momentum modes around the cylinder, kind of Kaluza-Klein modes. And since it's non-interacting, essentially, you can sum over this, over the contributions to the entanglement entropy of each momentum mode. And you know, each of those contributions is just a contribution of a 1 plus 1 dimensional theory. And in a 1 plus 1 dimensional theory, we know the entanglement entropy, Sicardi and Calabrese. And then we just sum those up, and we get some answer. So now, let me go, you know, this is not very interesting. It's non-interacting. Let me go to an interacting theory. Well, so this is the O4 model. This is the, we know the beta function for the interaction. We know that at small epsilon, there is this very nice Wilson-Fisher fixed point at weak coupling, and we can do perturbation theory. So typically, at leading order in epsilon, we can just do mean field. We can pretend that interactions do not exist. But it turns out that for this problem, one cannot do this. And the reason is the following. So here we have to work on an N-sheeted Riemann surface. So we have this conical singularity at the origin running along the boundary. And turns out that, you know, if your system has a boundary, you can have new operators being induced on the boundary. And you have to treat these operators in your scaling. So maybe you're familiar with the theory of boundary critical phenomena, where you know you just have a classical O(n) model and you put a boundary at some, you know, you look at it on a half infinite space. And then such an operator can be induced at the boundary. And essentially, one has to treat the flow of the coupling constant in front of this operator. And the flow actually gives you three types of surface critical phenomena. So there are kind of three fixed points, so-called ordinary transitions, extraordinary, and special, multicritical. So in our case, there is a very similar operator being induced along the conical singularity, just again, this phi squared operator. And we have gone to great pains to understand the flow of this operator. And you know, I will not go through all the details, but we have computed the beta function associated with this coupling. And this beta function has essentially two fixed points. There is one stable one. There is one unstable one. And it's the stable one that we are interested in. And that's the one that's going to control our entanglement entropy. Let's skip all of this. But the upshot is that turns out that you have to treat the flow of these boundary perturbations carefully. And once you've done that, at leading order in epsilon, you can, you know, there is a contribution from the free theory, which is what one would expect naively. And then there is a boundary correction, which comes from this operator. And it turns out that to leading order in epsilon, they cancel each other completely. At least the contribution to the entanglement entropy proper cancels out completely. And then, okay, so you know, so what happens at high orders? And that, you know, we were now really desperate because we wanted to get some answer. We didn't want to get zero. So we went and we have computed things to two-loop order. So we had computed this beta function to two-loop order. And you know, these calculations are a lot of fun because you know two loops is kind of fun even when you're in plane space. But now you are in space with a conical singularity, so you have to work with these propagators on an N-sheeted Riemann surface, and that we just love. And so we had to sum all of these graphs. Okay, and at the end we did get finite answer for this universal geometric correction. G is a...
G of phi phi.
G of phi phi is a function that depends on the twist along the... So I don't have an explicit expression for that function, but it's essentially some kind of a Jacobi theta function. Yeah, so I have a plot actually of this function. All right. I'll not discuss this. So there is, okay, so that basically, that's the story of why the interacting fixed point and the Wilson-Fisher and the non-interacting fixed point give you different answers when epsilon goes to zero. There is, you know, the other twist of the story that I had was that there is this funny business with the large n limit. And I don't really have time to discuss that. But let me just mention that there are very few, well, there are not that many cases known where naive large n counting fails. And, you know, all of you, many of you here study theories at large n. Let me give you two examples where this large n counting is known to fail. So one famous example is so-called resolution of Witten's U1 problem, where naively, you know, you expect that when you include a massless fermion into your theory, just from large n counting, it cannot change your topological susceptibility, but in fact it changes it dramatically. It makes it zero, and okay, that had to do with the existence of the eta prime Goldstone. Another violation that was discovered rather recently is for certain theories involving Fermi surfaces interacting with bosonic modes. So there again, large n counting has to be done in a clever fashion. So we found another. So our result is another example where naive large n counting doesn't work. Okay, so let me now conclude with some further directions that we can pursue in this problem. So we have only calculated this correlation length correction in the disordered phase where we had a mass gap. But then we expect there to be a similar correction in the ordered phase. And generally, you know, now I don't have to define what I mean by correlation length. I can just look at these corrections in terms of deviation from the critical point, and I can define these amplitude ratios, which will be universal. So that would be fun to compute. So S plus is the entanglement entropy in the disordered phase, and S minus is the entanglement entropy in the ordered phase. And T is the deviation from the critical point. Another interesting piece of work that I think should be done is to figure out what happens exactly at the upper critical dimension, what happens at d equal 3. Typically, at the upper critical dimension, there are extra logs which are possible. And so there are some interesting logs in the entanglement entropy here. And I think one should go ahead and figure out the structure. And final thing that I think would be interesting to do, but technically probably very hard, is to remember I started by talking about these logarithmic terms that appear if you have corners in your boundary or if you have endpoints in your boundary. So it would be, I think, interesting to calculate the coefficient of these logarithmic terms and verify that they're universal. But I think technically that's even harder calculation. Okay, that's all I wanted to say. Thanks.
Have you thought about studying the whole entanglement spectrum, or at least two eigenvalues of the entanglement spectrum, so that you can see at the quantum critical point what happens to the gap in entanglement? The entanglement spectrum. I mean, so there are some examples in which the quantum critical point, the gap in entanglement spectrum closes, and it closes with some exponent that is the same than the critical theory.
But if I look away from a critical point, so what exactly do you mean by gap in the entanglement spectrum?
So just the difference between the first and the second eigenvalue.
But typically I would, in the largest eigenvalue,
yeah.
I would expect that I would expect that actually vanishes in the thermodynamic limit, or as your subsystem size goes to infinity. Is that not so?
Well, there are examples in which it vanishes, like t minus t zero, where t zero is the quantum critical point to some dynamical exponent, and this dynamical exponent is the same than the quantum phase transition board.
And is it known what the what kind of theories at this point? Where are these computations then?
That's the thing. It is true in the X1 model.
Uh-huh.
For instance, and there are some other examples that.
One plus one dimensional?
Yes.
So just free fermions.
Yeah,
so I don't know. I think these things are quite difficult to study field theoretically, because the only way I know of extracting these quantities is using the replicate trick, right? And then you have to somehow you have to solve the problem of moments.
Yeah, no, in fact, the people who did it didn't use the
they just exactly from
the calculus. Exactly, computed the reduced density matrix. Now, I understand that from the replica trick, even if in principle you can construct the whole spectrum.
That's probably not the way to do it efficiently.
Yes. So I have a question for you. So there have been some claims that black hole entropy is disentanglement entropy, but black hole entropy does from several different computations have log of area corrections, but there's no corners on the horizon. So could that be used as an argument that black hole entropy is not entanglement entropy?
But black hole entropy goes as the area.
Right,
the
but there are corrections that go like log area. And they seem to have a universal coefficient of 3/2, no matter how you compute it.
You know, I think, yeah, that would be one way. But I think, you know, you get this area loss for anything in field theory. You don't need to have a black hole inside, essentially, in order to get an area loss.
Right. So it's controversial whether the explanation for the black hole entropy is an entanglement entropy.
Mm-hmm.
And what I'm saying is that if you say that the log of the area term should only appear if there's a corner, there is no corner, a black hole horizon is smooth, so maybe that suggests that black hole entropy is not entanglement.
But in 3 plus 1 dimensions, you can get logs. You can get logs for curved boundaries. So in 3 plus 1 dimensions, you can get logs.
Okay.
Even if you don't have corners.
Okay,
what is required?
It
has a
both extrinsic and intrinsic curvature.
Can you say something more about this quadratic, this n squared scaling? So specifically, was it in the leading term that you got this n squared scaling first of all?
So why would you
say that? You would expect it, first of all, and then why don't you get it, right? To say that you expect it seems something like saying that you're having an effective free field behavior at short distances.
Well, you have an O(n) model, and you're calculating partition function on an n-shaded Riemann surface. So this logarithm of this partition function, logarithm of partition function in O(n) model goes as n. That's it. Just general statement that you get from larger and common things. Because to a certain kind of, in a certain sense, this is a two leading order non-interacting problem. It's kind of mean cube like problem.
Okay, so given that, then how could you possibly get this quadratic?
Right. So it turns out, this quadratic thing appears in front of the M. In front of this term, M, L.
And this is two plus. You mean for the entropy, not the.
Yeah,
but not for the log Z.
But that's the same thing. The Arrhenia entropy is the logarithm of the partition function on an entropy determined surface. You have to put some prefactor, but. And it turns out that here, the limit M goes to 0 and M goes to infinity do not commute. So if you were working with.
M is the correlation, the inverse correlation then? What is M?
M is the gap, yeah. So sine is the inverse correlation length. Essentially, you start doing this and you get something like N, and then you get essentially 1, and then you get some kind of 1 over N log T over lambda squared, and then you get 1 over N squared log T over lambda squared. So, you know, at fixed mass, or at fixed deviation from the critical point, it looks like your large N expansion works perfectly well. But when you go ahead and you resum the logs, that is, you take the limit M to 0 first, and then N to infinity, which is kind of the correct infrared limit, then you get these additional powers. So you have to treat your RG equations carefully in order to reproduce this N squared.
So can you attach any physical picture to it? I mean, so that gave a kind of calculational explanation. What's wrong? I mean, if the picture that you had a sort of free behavior at short distances was valid in one case, why is it not valid in the other case?
You know, it's hard. It's even hard to argue physically by a sign of a beta function of certain value. So for something as, this has to do with the solution of a certain RG equation, and it has to do with a mysterious fact that this quantity nu times d minus 1 is close to 1 in the large N limit. So it's very hard to come up with a physical picture here.
Okay, so is there any question? Otherwise, let's thank Speaker once again.